prerogative which in his youth he had so vigorously attacked. At his request, the Empress Mother undertook the voyage of Thessalonica and the office of mediation. She returned without success. And unless Anne of Savoy was instructed by adversity, we may doubt the sincerity or at least the fervour of her zeal. While the regent grasped the scepter with a firm and vigorous hand, she'd been instructed to declare that the 10 years of his legal administration would soon elapse, and that, after a full trial of the vanity of the world, the Emperor Cantacuzini sighed for the repose of a cloister, and was ambitious only of a heavenly crown. Had these sentiments been genuine, his voluntary abdication would have restored the peace of the empire, and his conscience would have been relieved by an act of justice. Palaeologus alone was responsible for his future government, and whatever might be his vices, they were surely less formidable than the calamities of a civil war, in which the barbarians and infidels were again invited to assist the Greeks in their mutual destruction. By the arms of the Turks, who now struck a deep and everlasting root in Europe, Cantacuzini prevailed in the third contest in which he had been involved, and the young emperor, driven from the sea and land, was compelled to take shelter among the Latins of the Isle of Tenedos. His insolence and obstinacy provoked the victor to a step which must render the quarrel irreconcilable, and the association of his son Matthew, whom he invested with the purple, established the succession in the family of the Cantacuzini. But Constantinople was still attached to the blood of her ancient princes, and this last injury accelerated the restoration of the rightful heir. A noble Genoese espoused the cause of Palaeologus, obtained a promise of his sister, and achieved the revolution with 2 galleys and 2,500 auxiliaries. Under the pretense of distress, they were admitted into the lesser port. A gate was opened, and the Latin shout of long life and victory to the Emperor John Palaeologus was answered by a general rising in his favour. A numerous and loyal party yet adhered to the standard of Cantacuzini, but he asserts in his history, does he hope for belief, that his tender conscience rejected the assurance of conquest, that in free obedience to the voice of religion and philosophy, he descended from the throne and embraced with pleasure the monastic habit and profession. So soon as he ceased to be a prince, his successor was not unwilling that he should be a saint. The remainder of his life was devoted to piety and learning. In the cells of Constantinople and Mount Athos, the monk Joasaph was respected as the temporal and spiritual father of the emperor, and if he issued from his retreat, it was as the minister of peace to subdue the obstinacy and solicit the pardon of his rebellious son. Yet in the cloister, the mind of Cantacuzini was still exercised by theological war. He sharpened a controversial pen against the Jews and Mohammedans, and in every state he defended with equal zeal the divine light of Mount Thabor, a memorable question which consummates the religious follies of the Greeks. The fakirs of India and the monks of the Oriental Church were alike persuaded that in the total abstraction of the faculties of the mind and body, the purer spirit may ascend to the enjoyment and vision of the deity. The opinion and practice of the monasteries of Mount Athos will be best represented in the words of an abbot who flourished in the 11th century. "When thou art alone in thy cell," says the ascetic teacher, "shut thy door and seat thyself in a corner. Raise thy mind above all things vain and transitory. Recline thy beard and chin on thy breast. Turn thy eyes and thy thoughts toward the middle of thy belly, the region of the navel, and search the place of the heart, the seat of the soul. At first all will be dark and comfortless, but if you persevere day and night, you will feel an ineffable joy. And no sooner has the soul discovered the place of the heart than it is involved in a mystic and ethereal light." This light, the production of a distempered fancy, the creature of an empty stomach and an empty brain, was adored by the quietists as the pure and perfect essence of God himself. And as long as the folly was confined to Mount Athos, the simple solitaries were not inquisitive how the divine essence could be a material substance, or how an immaterial substance could be perceived by the eyes of the body. But in the reign of the younger Andronicus, these monasteries were visited by Balaam, a Calabrian monk who was equally skilled in philosophy and theology, who possessed the language of the Greeks and Latins, and whose versatile genius could maintain their opposite creeds, according to the interest of the moment. The indiscretion of an ascetic revealed to the curious traveller the secrets of mental prayer, and Balaam embraced the opportunity of ridiculing the quietists, who placed the soul in the navel, of accusing the monks of Mount Athos of heresy and blasphemy. His attack compelled the more learned to renounce or dissemble the simple devotion of their brethren, and Gregory Palamas introduced a scholastic distinction between the essence and operation of God. His inaccessible essence dwells in the midst of an uncreated and eternal light, and this beatific vision of the saints had been manifested to the disciples on Mount Tabor, in the transfiguration of Christ. Yet this distinction could not escape the reproach of polytheism. The eternity of the light of Tabor was fiercely denied, and Balaam still charged the Palamites with holding two eternal substances, a visible and an invisible God. From the rage of the monks of Mount Athos, who threatened his life, the Calabrian retired to Constantinople, where his smooth and specious manners introduced him to the favour of the great domestic and the emperor. The court and the city were involved in this theological dispute, which flamed amidst the civil war. But the doctrine of Balaam was disgraced by his flight and apostasy. The Palamites triumphed, and their adversary, the patriarch John of Apri, was deposed by the consent of the adverse factions of the state. Then the character of emperor and theologian, Cantacuzini, presided in the synod of the Greek Church, which established as an article of faith the uncreated light of Mount Tabor. And after so many insults, the reason of mankind was slightly wounded by the addition of a single absurdity. Many rolls of paper or parchment have been blotted, and the impenitent sectaries who refused to subscribe the orthodox creed were deprived of the honors of Christian burial. But in the next age the question was forgotten, nor can I learn that the axe or the faggot were employed for the extirpation of the Balaamite heresy. For the conclusion of this chapter, I have reserved the Genoese War, which shook the throne of Cantacuzini, and betrayed the debility of the Greek Empire. The Genoese, who, after the recovery of Constantinople, were seated in the suburb of Pera, or Galata, received that honourable fief from the bounty of the emperor. They were indulged in the use of their laws and magistrates, but they submitted to the duties of vassals and subjects. The forcible word of liegemen was borrowed from the Latin jurisprudence, and their podesta, or chief, before he entered on his office, saluted the emperor with loyal acclamations and vows of fidelity. Genoa sealed a firm allowance with the Greeks, and, in case of a defensive war, a supply of 50 empty galleys, and a succor of 50 galleys completely armed and manned, was promised by the Republic to the emperor. In the revival of a naval force, it was the aim of Michael Palaeologus to deliver himself from a foreign aid, and his vigorous government contained the Genoese of Galata within those limits which the insolence of wealth and freedom provoked them to exceed. A sailor threatened that they should soon be masters of Constantinople, and slew the Greek who resented this national affront. And an armed vessel, after refusing to salute the palace, was guilty of some acts of piracy in the Black Sea. Their countrymen threatened to support their cause, but the long and open village of Galata was instantly surrounded by the imperial troops, till, in the moment of the assault, the prostrate Genoese implored the clemency of their sovereign. The defenseless situation which secured their obedience exposed them to the attack of their Venetian rivals, who, in the reign of the elder Andronicus, presumed to violate the majesty of the throne. On the approach of their fleets, the Genoese, with their families and effects, retired into the city. Their empty habitations were reduced to ashes, and the feeble prince, who had viewed the destruction of his suburb, expressed his resentment not by arms, but by ambassadors. This misfortune, however, was advantageous to the Genoese, who obtained and imperceptibly abused the dangerous license of surrounding Galata with a strong wall, of introducing into the ditch the waters of the sea, of erecting lofty turrets, and of mounting a train of military engines on the rampart. The narrow bounds in which they had been circumscribed were insufficient for the growing colony. Each day they acquired some addition of landed property, and the adjacent hills were covered with their villas and castles, which they joined and protected by new fortifications. The navigation and trade of the Black Sea was the patrimony of the Greek emperors, who commanded the narrow entrance, the gates, as it were, of that inland sea. In the reign of Michael Palaeologus, their prerogative was acknowledged by the Sultan of Egypt, who solicited and obtained the liberty of sending an annual ship for the purchase of slaves in Circassia and the Lesser Tartary, a liberty pregnant with misbelief to the Christian cause. Since these youths were transformed by education and discipline into the formidable Mamelukes. From the colony of Pera, the Genoese engaged with superior advantage in the lucrative trade of the Black Sea, and their industry supplied the Greeks with fish and corn. Two articles of food almost equally important to a superstitious people. The spontaneous bounty of nature appears to have bestowed the harvests of Ukraine, the produce of a rude and savage husbandry. Then the endless exportation of saltfish and caviar is annually renewed by the enormous sturgeons that are caught at the mouth of the Don or Tanais in their last station of the rich mud and shallow water of the Myotis. The waters of the Oxus, the Caspian, the Volga, and the Don opened a rare and laborious passage for the gems and spices of India, and after 3 months' march, the caravans of Carizmi met the Italian vessels in the harbors of Crimea. These various branches of trade were monopolized by the diligence and power of the Genoese. Their rivals of Venice and Pisa were forcibly expelled. The natives were awed by the castles and cities which arose on the foundations of their humble factories, and their principal establishment of Kaffa was besieged without effect by the Tartar powers. Destitute of a navy, the Greeks were oppressed by these haughty merchants, who fed, or famished, Constantinople according to their interest. They proceeded to usurp the customs, the fishery, and even the toll of the Bosphorus. And while they derived from these objects a revenue of 200,000 pieces of gold, a remnant of 30,000 was reluctantly allowed to the emperor. The colony of Pera, or Galata, acted in peace and war as an independent state, and as it will happen in distant settlements, the Genoese Podesta too often forgot that he was the servant of his own masters. These usurpations were encouraged by the weakness of the elder Andronicus and by the civil wars that afflicted his age and the minority of his grandson. The talents of Cantacuzini were employed to the ruin rather than the restoration of the empire, and after his domestic victory he was condemned to an ignominious trial, whether the Greeks or the Genoese should reign in Constantinople. The merchants of Pera were offended by his refusal of some contiguous land, some commanding heights which they proposed to cover with new fortifications, and in the absence of the emperor, who was detained at Demotica by sickness, they ventured to brave the debility of a female reign. A Byzantine vessel, which had presumed to fish at the mouth of the harbour, was sunk by these audacious strangers. The fishermen were murdered. Instead of suing for pardon, the Genoese demanded satisfaction, required, in a haughty strain, that the Greeks should renounce the exercise of navigation, and encountered with regular arms the first sallies of the popular indignation. They instantly occupied the debatable land, and by the labor of a whole people, of either sex and of every age, the wall was raised and the ditch was sunk with incredible speed. At the same time, they attacked and burnt two Byzantine galleys, while the three others, the remainder of the imperial navy, escaped from their hands. The habitations without the gates or along the shore were pillaged and destroyed, and the care of the regent, of the Empress Irene, was confined to the preservation of the city. The return of Cantacuzini dispelled the public consternation. The emperor inclined to peaceful counsels, but he yielded to the obstinacy of his enemies, who rejected all reasonable terms, and to the ardor of his subjects, who threatened, in the style of Scripture, to break them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Yet they reluctantly paid the taxes that he imposed for the construction of ships and the expenses of the war. And as the two nations were masters, the one of the land, the other of the sea, Constantinople and Pera were pressed for the evils of a mutual siege. The merchants of the colony, who had believed that a few days would terminate the war, already murmured at their losses. The succors from their mother country were delayed by the factions of Genoa, and the most cautious embraced the opportunity of a Rhodian vessel to remove their families and effects from the scene of hostility. In the spring, the Byzantine fleet, 7 galleys and a train of smaller vessels, issued from the mouth of the harbour and steered in a single line along the shore of Pera, unskillfully presenting their sides to the beaks of the adverse squadron. The crews were composed of peasants and mechanics, nor was their ignorance compensated by the native courage of barbarians. The wind was strong, the waves were rough, and no sooner did the Greeks perceive a distant and inactive enemy than they leaped headlong into the sea from a doubtful to an inevitable peril. The troops that marched to the attack of the lines of Pera were struck at the same moment with a similar panic, and the Genoese were astonished and almost ashamed at their double victory. Their triumphant vessels, crowned with flowers and dragging after them the captive galleys, repeatedly passed and repassed before the palace. The only virtue of the emperor was patience, and the hope of revenge his sole consolation. Yet the distress of both parties interposed a temporary agreement, and the shame of the empire was disguised by a thin veil of dignity and power. Summoning the chiefs of the colony, Cantacuzini affected to despise the trivial object of the debate, and after a mild reproof, most liberally granted the lands which had been previously resigned to the seeming custody of his officers. But the emperor was soon solicited to violate the treaty and to join his arms with the Venetians, the perpetual enemies of Genoa and her colonies. While he compared the reasons of peace and war, his moderation was provoked by wanton insult of the inhabitants of Pera, who discharged from their rampart a large stone that fell in the midst of Constantinople. On his just complaint, they coldly blamed the imprudence of their engineer. But the next day the insult was repeated, and they exulted in a second proof that the royal city was not beyond the reach of their artillery. Cantacuzini instantly signed his treaty with the Venetians, but the weight of the Roman Empire was scarcely felt in the balance of these opulent and powerful republics. From the Straits of Gibraltar to the mouth of the Tanais, their fleets encountered each other with various success, and a memorable battle was fought in the narrow sea under the walls of Constantinople. It would not be an easy task to reconcile the accounts of the Greeks, the Venetians, and the Genoese. And while I depend on the narrative of an impartial historian, I shall borrow from each nation the facts that redound to their own disgrace and the honor of their foes. The Venetians, with their allies, the Catalans, had the advantage of number, and their fleet, with the poor addition of 8 Byzantine galleys, amounted to 75 sail. The Genoese did not exceed 64, but in those times their ships of war were distinguished by the superiority of their size and strength. The names and families of their naval commanders, Pisani and Doria, are illustrious in the annals of their country. But the personal merit of the former was eclipsed by the fame and abilities of his rival. They engaged in tempestuous weather, and the tumultuary conflict was continued from the dawn to the extinction of light. The enemies of the Genoese applaud their prowess. The friends of the Venetians are dissatisfied with their behavior. But all parties agree in praising the skill and boldness of the Catalans, who, with many wounds, sustained the brunt of the action. On the separation of the fleets, the event might appear doubtful, but the 13 Genoese galleys that had been sunk or taken were compensated by double loss of the allies of 14 Venetians, 10 Catalans, and 2 Greeks. And even the grief of the conquerors expressed the assurance and habit of more decisive victories. Pisani confessed his defeat by retiring into a fortified harbor, from whence, under the pretext of the orders of the Senate, he steered with a broken and flying squadron for the Isle of Candia, and abandoned to his rivals the sovereignty of the sea. In a public epistle addressed to the Doge and Senate, Petrarch employs his eloquence to reconcile the maritime powers, the two luminaries of Italy. The orator celebrates the valor and victory of the Genoese, the first of men in the exercise of naval war. He drops a tear on the misfortunes of their Venetian brethren, but he exhorts them to pursue with fire and sword the base and perfidious Greeks, to purge the metropolis of the East from the heresy with which it was infected. Deserted by their friends, the Greeks were incapable of resistance. And 3 months after the battle, the Emperor Cantacuzini solicited and subscribed a treaty which forever banished the Venetians and Catalans and granted to the Genoese a monopoly of trade and almost a right of dominion. The Roman Empire, I smile in transcribing the name, might soon have sunk into a province of Genoa if the ambition of the Republic had not been checked by the ruin of her freedom and naval power. A long contest of 130 years was determined by the triumph of Venice, and the factions of the Genoese compelled them to seek for domestic peace under the protection of a foreign lord, the Duke of Milan or the French king. Yet the spirit of commerce survived that of conquest, and the colony of Pera still awed the capital and navigated the Black Sea, till it was involved by the Turks in the final servitude of Constantinople itself. Chapter 64 Conquests of Genghis Khan and the Moguls from China to Poland. Escape of Constantinople and the Greeks. Origin of the Ottoman Turks in Bithynia. Reigns and victories of Othman, Orkhan, Amurath I, and Bajazet I. Foundation and progress of the Turkish monarchy in Asia and Europe. Danger of Constantinople and the Greek Empire. From the petty quarrels of a city and her suburbs, from the cowardice and discord of the falling Greeks, I shall now ascend to the victorious Turks, whose domestic slavery was ennobled by martial discipline, religious enthusiasm, and the energy of the national character. The rise and progress of the Ottomans, the present sovereigns of Constantinople, are connected with the most important scenes of modern history. but they are founded on a previous knowledge of the great eruption of the Mughals and Tatars, whose rapid conquests may be compared with the primitive convulsions of nature, which have agitated and altered the surface of the globe. I have long since asserted my claim to introduce the nations, the immediate or remote authors of the fall of the Roman Empire, nor can I refuse myself to those events which, from their uncommon magnitude, will interest a philosophic mind in the history of blood. These ancient seats of the Huns and Turks were occupied in the 12th century by many pastoral tribes, of the same descent and similar manners, which were united and led to conquest by the formidable Genghis. In his ascent to greatness, that barbarian, whose private appellation was Temujin, had trampled on the necks of his equals. His birth was noble, but it was the pride of victory that the prince or people deduced his seventh ancestor from the immaculate conception of a virgin. His father had reigned over 13 hordes, which composed about 30,000 or 40,000 families. Above two-thirds refused to pay tithes or obedience to his infant son, and at the age of 13, Temujin fought a battle against his rebellious subjects. The future conqueror of Asia was reduced to fly and to obey, but he rose superior to his fortune, and in his 40th year he had established his fame and dominion over the circumjacent tribes. In a state of society in which policy is rude and valor is universal, the ascendant of one man must be founded on his power and resolution to punish his enemies and recompense his friends. His first military league was ratified by the simple rites of sacrificing a horse and tasting of a running stream. Temujin pledged himself to divide with his followers the sweets and the bitters of life, and when he had shared among them his horses and apparel, he was rich in their gratitude and his own hopes. After his first victory, he placed 70 cauldrons on the fire, and 70 of the most guilty rebels were cast headlong into the boiling water. The sphere of his attraction was continually enlarged by the ruin of the proud and the submission of the prudent, and the boldest chieftains might tremble when they beheld, enchased in silver, the skull of the Khan of Kerites, who, under the name of Prester John, had corresponded with the Roman pontiff and the princes of Europe. The ambition of Temujin condescended to employ the arts of superstition, and it was from a naked prophet who could ascend to heaven on a white horse that he accepted the title of Genghis, the most great, and a divine right to the conquest and dominion of the earth. In a general kurultai, or diet, he was seated on a felt, which was long afterwards revered as a relic, and solemnly proclaimed Great Khan, or Emperor of the Mughals and Tatars. Of these kindred, though rival names, the former had given birth to the imperial race, and the latter has been extended by accident or error over the spacious wilderness of the north. The code of laws which Genghis dictated to his subjects was adapted to the preservation of a domestic peace and the exercise of foreign hostility. The punishment of death was inflicted on the crimes of adultery, murder, perjury, and the capital thefts of a horse or ox, and the fiercest of men were mild and just in their intercourse with each other. The future election of the Great Khan was vested in the princes of his family and the heads of the tribes, and the regulations of the chase were essential to the pleasures and plenty of a Tatar camp. The victorious nation was held sacred from all servile labors, which were abandoned to slaves and strangers, and every labor was servile except the profession of arms. The service and discipline of the troops, who were armed with bows, scimitars, and iron maces, and divided by hundreds, thousands, and ten thousands, were the institutions of a veteran commander. Each officer and soldier was made responsible under pain of death for the safety and honor of his companions, and the spirit of conquest breathed in the law that peace should never be granted unless to a vanquished and suppliant enemy. But it is the religion of Genghis that best deserves our wonder and applause. The Catholic inquisitors of Europe, who defended nonsense by cruelty, might have been confounded by the example of a barbarian who anticipated the lessons of philosophy and established by his laws a system of pure theism and perfect toleration. His first and only article of faith was the existence of one God, the author of all good, who fills by his presence the heavens and earth, which he has created by his power. The Tatars and Mughals were addicted to the idols of their peculiar tribes, and many of them had been converted by the foreign missionaries to the religions of Moses, of Muhammad, and of Christ. These various systems in freedom and concord were taught and practiced within the precincts of the same camp, and the bonds, the imam, the rabbi, the Nestorian, and the Latin priest enjoyed the same honorable exemption from service and tribute. In the mosque of Bukhara, the insolent victor might trample the Quran under his horse's feet, but the calm legislator respected the prophets and pontiffs of the most hostile sects. The reason of Genghis was not informed by books. The Khan could neither read nor write, and except the tribe of the Uyghurs, the greatest part of the Mughals and Tatars were as illiterate as their sovereign. The memory of their exploits was preserved by tradition. 68 years after the death of Genghis, these traditions were collected and transcribed. The brevity of their domestic annals may be supplied by the Chinese, Persians, Armenians, Syrians, Arabians, Greeks, Russians, Poles, Hungarians, and Latins. And each nation will deserve credit in the relation of their own disasters and defeats. The arms of Genghis and his lieutenants successively reduced the hordes of the desert, who pitched their tents between the wall of China and the Volga. And the Mughal emperor became the monarch of the pastoral world, the lord of many millions of shepherds and soldiers who felt their united strength and were impatient to rush on the mild and wealthy climes of the south. His ancestors had been the tributaries of the Chinese emperors, and Temujin himself had been disgraced by a title of honor and servitude. The court of Peking was astonished by an embassy from its former vassal, who, in the tone of the King of Nations, exacted the tribute and obedience which he had paid, and who affected to treat the Son of Heaven as the most contemptible of mankind. A haughty answer disguised their secret apprehensions, and their fears were soon justified by the march of innumerable squadrons, who pierced on all sides the feeble rampart of the Great Wall. 90 cities were stormed or starved by the Mughals. 10 only escaped, and Genghis, from a knowledge of the filial piety of the Chinese, covered his vanguard with their captive parents, an unworthy and by degrees a fruitless abuse of the virtue of his enemies. His invasion was supported by the revolt of 100,000 Khitans who guarded the frontier. Yet he listened to a treaty, and a princess of China, 3,000 horses, 500 youths, and as many virgins, and a tribute of gold and silk were the price of his retreat. In his second expedition, he compelled the Chinese emperor to retire beyond the Yellow River to a more southern residence. The siege of Peking was long and laborious. The inhabitants were reduced by famine to decimate and devour their fellow citizens. When their ammunition was spent, they discharged ingots of gold and silver from their engines. But the Mughals introduced a mine to the center of the capital, and the conflagration of the palace burnt above 30 days. China was desolated by Tatar war and domestic faction, and the 5 northern provinces were added to the empire of Genghis. In the west he touched the dominions of Muhammad, Sultan of Khwarizmi, who reigned from the Persian Gulf to the borders of India and Turkestan, and who, in the proud imitation of Alexander the Great, forgot the servitude and ingratitude of his fathers to the House of Seljuk. It was the wish of Genghis to establish a friendly and commercial intercourse with the most powerful of the Muslim princes. nor could he be tempted by the secret solicitations of the Caliph of Baghdad, who sacrificed to his personal wrongs the safety of the church and state. A rash and inhuman deed provoked and justified the Tatar arms in the invasion of the southern Asia. A caravan of 3 ambassadors and 150 merchants were arrested and murdered at Otra by the command of Muhammad. Nor was it till after a demand and denial of justice, till he had prayed and fasted 3 nights on a mountain, that the Mughal emperor appealed to the judgment of God and his sword. Our European battles, says a philosophic writer, are petty skirmishes if compared to the numbers that have fought and fallen in the fields of Asia. 700,000 Mughals and Tatars are said to have marched under the standard of Genghis and his 4 sons. In the vast plains that extend to the north of the Sihon, or Jaxartes, they were encountered by 400,000 soldiers of the Sultan, and in the first battle, which was suspended by the night, 160,000 Kharizmians were slain. Muhammad was astounded by the multitude and valor of his enemies. He withdrew from the scene of danger and distributed his troops in the frontier towns, trusting that the barbarians, invincible in the field, would be repulsed by the length and difficulty of so many regular sieges. But the prudence of Genghis had formed a body of Chinese engineers, skilled in the mechanic arts, informed, perhaps, of the secret of gunpowder, and capable under his discipline of attacking a foreign country with more vigor and success than they had defended their own. The Persian historians will relate the sieges and reduction of Otra, Khojende, Bukhara, Samarkand, Kharizmi, Herat, Maru, Nisabur, Balkh, and Kandahar, and the conquest of the rich and populous countries of Transoxiana, Kharizmi, and Khorasan. The destructive hostilities of Attila and the Huns have long since been elucidated by the example of Genghis and the Mughals, and in this more proper place I shall be content to observe that, from the Caspian to the Indus, they ruined a tract of many 100 miles, which was adorned with the habitations and labors of mankind, and that 5 centuries have not been sufficient to repair the ravages of 4 years. The Mughal emperor encouraged or indulged the fury of his troops. The hope of future possession was lost in the ardor of rapine and slaughter, and the cause of the war exasperated their native fierceness by the pretense of justice and revenge. The downfall and death of the Sultan Muhammad, who expired, unpitied and alone, in a desert island of the Caspian Sea, is a poor atonement for the calamities of which he was the author. Could the Kharizmian Empire have been saved by a single hero, it would have been saved by his son, Jalal ad-Din, whose active valor repeatedly checked the Mughals in the career of victory. Retreating, as he fought, to the banks of the Indus, he was oppressed by their innumerable host, till, in the last moment of despair, Jalal ad-Din spurred his horse into the waves, swam one of the broadest and most rapid rivers of Asia, and extorted the admiration and applause of Genghis himself. It was in this camp that the Mughal conqueror yielded with reluctance to the murmurs of his weary and wealthy troops, who sighed for the enjoyment of their native land. Encumbered with the spoils of Asia, he slowly measured back his footsteps, betrayed some pity for the misery of the vanquished, and declared his intention of rebuilding the cities which had been swept away by the tempest of his arms. After he had repassed the Oxus and Jaxartes, he was joined by 2 generals whom he had detached with 30,000 horse to subdue the western provinces of Persia. They had trampled on the nations which opposed their passage, penetrated through the gates of Derbent, traversed the Volga and the desert, and accomplished the circuit of the Caspian Sea by an expedition which had never been attempted and has never been repeated. The return of Genghis was signalized by the overthrow of the rebellious or independent kingdoms of Tartary, and he died in the fullness of years and glory, with his last breath exhorting and instructing his sons to achieve the conquest of the Chinese Empire. The harem of Genghis was composed of 500 wives and concubines, and of his numerous progeny, 4 sons, illustrious by their birth and merit, exercised under their father the principal offices of peace and war. Tushi was his great huntsman, Zagatai his judge, Oktai his minister, and Tule his general, and their names and actions are often conspicuous in the history of his conquests. Firmly united for their own and the public interest, the 3 brothers and their families were content with dependent scepters, and Oktai, by general consent, was proclaimed Great Khan, or Emperor of the Mughals and Tartars. He was succeeded by his son Gayuk, after whose death the empire devolved to his cousins Mangu and Kublai, the sons of Tule, and the grandsons of Genghis. In the 68 years of his 4 first successors, the Mughal subdued almost all Asia and a large portion of Europe. Without confining myself to the order of time, without expatiating on the detail of events, I shall present a general picture of the progress of their arms. 1 in the east, 2 in the south, 3 in the west, and 4 in the north. Before the invasion of Genghis, China was divided into 2 empires or dynasties of the north and south, and the difference of origin and interest was smoothed by general conformity of laws, language, and national manners. The Northern Empire, which had been dismembered by Genghis, was finally subdued 7 years after his death. After the loss of Peking, the emperor had fixed his residence at Kaifeng, a city many leagues in circumference, and which contained, according to the Chinese annals, 1,500,000 families of inhabitants and fugitives. He escaped from thence with only 7 horsemen, and made his last stand in a 3rd capital, till at length the hopeless monarch, protesting his innocence and accusing his fortune, ascended a funeral pile, and gave orders that as soon as he had stabbed himself, the fire should be kindled by his attendants. The dynasty of the Song, the native and ancient sovereigns of the whole empire, survived about 45 years the fall of the northern usurpers, and the perfect conquest was reserved for the arms of Kublai. During this interval, the Mughals were often diverted by foreign wars, and if the Chinese seldom dared to meet their victors in the field, their passive courage presented an endless succession of cities to storm and of millions to slaughter. In the attack and defense of places, the engines of antiquity and the Greek fire were alternately employed. The use of gunpowder in cannon and bombs appears as a familiar practice, and the sieges were conducted by the Mohammedans and Franks, who had been liberally invited into the service of Kublai. After passing the great river, the troops and artillery were conveyed along a series of canals till they invested the royal residence of Hamchu, or Quinsay, in the country of silk, the most delicious climate of China. The emperor, a defenseless youth, surrendered his person and scepter, and before he was sent in exile into Tartary, he struck 9 times the ground with his forehead to adore in prayer or thanksgiving the mercy of the great Khan. Yet the war, that was now styled a rebellion, was still maintained in the southern provinces from Hamchu to Canton, and the obstinate remnant of independence and hostility was transported from the land to the sea. But when the fleet of the Song was surrounded and oppressed by superior armament, their last champion leaped into the waves with his infant emperor in his arms. "It is more glorious," he cried, "to die a prince than to live a slave." 100,000 Chinese imitated his example, and the whole empire, from Tonkin to the Great Wall, submitted to the dominion of Kublai. His boundless ambition aspired to the conquest of Japan. His fleet was twice shipwrecked, and the lives of 100,000 Mughals and Chinese were sacrificed in the fruitless expedition. But the circumjacent kingdoms, Korea, Tonkin, Cochinchina, Pegu, Bengal, and Tibet, were reduced in different degrees of tribute and obedience by the effort or terror of his arms. He explored the Indian Ocean with a fleet of 1,000 ships. They sailed in 68 days, most probably to the Isle of Borneo, under the equinoctial line. And though they returned not without spoil or glory, the emperor was dissatisfied that the savage king had escaped from their hands. The conquest of Hindustan by the Mughals was reserved in a later period for the House of Timur, but that of Iran or Persia was achieved by Hulagu Khan, the grandson of Genghis, the brother and lieutenant of the two successive emperors, Mangu and Kublai. I shall not enumerate the crowd of sultans, emirs, and atabeks whom he trampled into dust, but the extirpation of the assassins or Ismailians of Persia may be considered as a service to mankind. Among the hills to the south of the Caspian, these odious sectaries had reigned with impunity above 160 years, and their prince or imam established his lieutenant to lead and govern the colony of Mount Libanus, so famous and formidable to the history of the Crusades. With the fanaticism of the Koran, the Ismailians had blended the Indian transmigration and the visions of their own prophets, and it was their first duty to devote their souls and bodies in blind obedience to the vicar of God. The daggers of his missionaries were felt both in the east and west. The Christians and the Muslims enumerate, and persons multiply, the illustrious victims that were sacrificed to the zeal, avarice, or resentment of the old man, as he was corruptly styled, of the mountain. But these daggers, his only arms, were broken by the sword of Hulagu, and not a vestige is left of the enemies of mankind, except the word assassin, which, in the most odious sense, has been adopted in the languages of Europe. The extinction of the Abbasides cannot be indifferent to the spectators of their greatness and decline. Since the fall of their Seljukian tyrants, the caliphs had recovered their lawful dominion of Baghdad and the Arabian Iraq. But the city was distracted by theological factions, and the commander of the faithful was lost in a harem of 700 concubines. The invasion of the Mughals he encountered with feeble arms and haughty embassies. "On the divine decree," said the caliph Mustasim, "is founded the throne of the sons of Abbas, and their foes shall surely be destroyed in this world and in the next. Who is this Hulagu that dares to rise against them? If he be desirous of peace, let him instantly depart from the sacred territory, and perhaps he may obtain from our clemency the pardon of his fault." This presumption was cherished by a perfidious vizier, who assured his master that even if the barbarians had entered the city, the women and children from the terraces would be sufficient to overwhelm them with stones. But when Hulagu touched the phantom, it instantly vanished into smoke. After a siege of 2 months, Baghdad was stormed and sacked by the Mughals, and their savage commander pronounced the death of the caliph Mustasim, the last of the temporal successors of Muhammad, whose noble kinsmen of the race of Abbas had reigned in Asia above 500 years. Whatever might be the designs of the conqueror, the holy cities of Mecca and Medina were protected by the Arabian desert. But the Mughals spread beyond the Tigris and Euphrates, pillaged Aleppo and Damascus, and threatened to join the Franks in the deliverance of Jerusalem. Egypt was lost had she been defended only by her feeble offspring, but the Mamelukes had breathed in their infancy the keenness of a Scythian air. Equal in valor, superior in discipline, They met the Mughals in many a well-fought field, and drove back the stream of hostility to the eastward of the Euphrates. But it overflowed with resistless violence the kingdoms of Armenia and Anatolia, of which the former was possessed by the Christians and the latter by the Turks. The sultans of Iconium opposed some resistance to the Mughal arms, till Azzadin sought a refuge among the Greeks of Constantinople, and his feeble successors, the last of the Seljukian dynasty, were finally extirpated by the Khans of Persia. No sooner had Oktai subverted the northern empire of China than he resolved to visit with his arms the most remote countries of the West. 1,500,000 Mughals and Tatars were inscribed on the military roll. Of these, the great Khan selected a third, which he entrusted to the command of his nephew Batu, the son of Tuli, who reigned over his father's conquests to the north of the Caspian Sea. After a festival of 40 days, Batu set forwards on this great expedition, and such was the speed and ardor of his innumerable squadrons that in less than 6 years they had measured a line of 90 degrees of longitude, a fourth part of the circumference of the globe. The great rivers of Asia and Europe, the Volga and Kama, the Don and Borysthenes, the Vistula and Danube, they either swam with their horses or passed on the ice, or traversed in leathern boats, which followed the camp and transported their wagons and artillery. By the first victories of Batu, the remains of national freedom were eradicated in the immense plains of Turkestan and Kipzak. In his rapid progress, he overran the kingdoms, as they are now styled, of Astrakhan and Kazan, and the troops which he detached towards Mount Caucasus explored the most secret recesses of Georgia and Circassia. The civil discord of the great dukes or princes of Russia betrayed their country to the Tatars. They spread from Livonia to the Black Sea, and both Moscow and Kiev, the modern and the ancient capitals, were reduced to ashes. A temporary ruin, less fatal than the deep and perhaps indelible mark which a servitude of 200 years has imprinted on the character of the Russians. The Tatars ravaged with equal fury the countries which they hoped to possess, and those which they were hastening to leave. From the permanent conquest of Russia they made a deadly, though transient, inroad into the heart of Poland, and as far as the borders of Germany. The cities of Lublin and Krakow were obliterated. They approached the shores of the Baltic, and in the Battle of Liegnitz they defeated the Dukes of Silesia, the Polish Palatines, and the great master of the Teutonic Order, and filled 9 sacks with the right ears of the slain. From Liegnitz, the extreme point of their western march, they turned aside to the invasion of Hungary, and the presence or spirit of Batu inspired the host of 500,000 men. The Carpathian hills could not be long impervious to their divided columns, and their approach had been fondly disbelieved, till it was irresistibly felt. The king, Bela the IV, assembled the military force of his counts and bishops, but he had alienated the nation by adopting a vagrant horde of 40,000 families of Comans, and these savage guests were provoked to revolt by the suspicion of treachery and the murder of their prince. The whole country north of the Danube was lost in a day, and depopulated in a summer. Then the ruins of cities and churches were overspread with the bones of the natives, who expiated the sins of their Turkish ancestors. An ecclesiastic who fled from the sack of Waradin describes the calamities which he had seen or suffered, and the sanguinary rage of sieges and battles is far less atrocious than the treatment of the fugitives, who had been allured from the woods under a promise of peace and pardon, and who were coolly slaughtered as soon as they had performed the labors of the harvest and vintage. In the winter the Tatars passed the Danube on the ice and advanced to Gran, or Strigonium, a German colony and the metropolis of the kingdom. 30 engines were planted against the walls. The ditches were filled with sacks of earth and dead bodies, and after a promiscuous massacre, 300 noble matrons were slain in the presence of the Khan. Of all the cities and fortresses of Hungary, three alone survived the Tatar invasion, and the unfortunate Bata hid his head among the islands of the Adriatic. The Latin world was darkened by this cloud of savage hostility. A Russian fugitive carried the alarm to Sweden, and the remote nations of the Baltic and the ocean trembled at the approach of the Tatars, whom their fear and ignorance were inclined to separate from the human species. Since the invasion of the Arabs in the 8th century, Europe had never been exposed to a similar calamity, and if the disciples of Mohammed would have oppressed her religion and liberty, it might be apprehended that the shepherds of Scythia would extinguish her cities, her arts, and all the institutions of civil society. The Roman pontiff attempted to appease and convert these invincible pagans by a mission of Franciscan and Dominican friars. But he was astonished by the reply of the Khan that the sons of God and of Genghis were invested with a divine power to subdue or extirpate the nations, and that the Pope would be involved in the universal destruction unless he visited in person and as a suppliant the royal horde. The Emperor Frederick II embraced a more generous mode of defense, and his letters to the kings of France and England and the princes of Germany represented the common danger and urged them to arm their vassals in this just and rational crusade. The Tatars themselves were awed by the fame and valor of the Franks. The town of Neustadt in Austria was bravely defended against them by 50 knights and 20 crossbows, and they raised the siege on the appearance of a German army. After wasting the adjacent kingdoms of Serbia, Bosnia, and Bulgaria, Batu slowly retreated from the Danube to the Volga to enjoy the rewards of victory in the city and palace of Sarai, which started at his command from the midst of the desert. Even the poor and frozen regions of the north attracted the arms of the Mughals. Shaibani Khan, the brother of the great Batu, led a horde of 15,000 families into the wilds of Siberia, and his descendants reigned at Tobolskoy above 3 centuries till the Russian conquest. The spirit of enterprise which pursued the course of the Obi and Yenisei must have led to the discovery of the icy sea. After brushing away the monstrous fables of men with dogs' heads and cloven feet, we shall find that 15 years after the death of Genghis, the Mughals were informed of the name and manners of the Samoyedes in the neighborhood of the Polar Circle, who dwelt in subterraneous huts, and derived their furs and their food from the sole occupation of hunting. While China, Syria, and Poland were invaded at the same time by the Mughals and Tatars, the authors of the mighty mischief were content with the knowledge and declaration that their word was the sword of death. Like the first caliphs, the first successors of Genghis seldom appeared in person at the head of their victorious armies. On the banks of the Onon and Selinga, the royal or golden horde exhibited the contrast of simplicity and greatness, of the roasted sheep and mare's milk which composed their banquets, and of a distribution in one day of 500 wagons of gold and silver. The ambassadors and princes of Europe and Asia were compelled to undertake this distant and laborious pilgrimage, and the life and reign of the great dukes of Russia, the kings of Georgia and Armenia, the sultans of Iconium, and the emirs of Persia were decided by the frown or smile of the great Khan. The sons and grandsons of Genghis had been accustomed to the pastoral life, but the village of Karakorum was gradually ennobled by their election and residence. A change of manners is implied in the removal of Oktai and Mangu from a tent to a house, and their example was imitated by the princes of their family and the great officers of the empire. Instead of the boundless forest, the enclosure of a park afforded the more indolent pleasures of the chase. Their new habitations were decorated with painting and sculpture. Their superfluous treasures were cast in fountains and basins and statues of massy silver. And the artists of China and Paris vied with each other in the service of the great Khan. Karakoram contained two streets, the one of Chinese mechanics, the other of Mohammedan traders, and the places of religious worship, one Nestorian church, two mosques, and 12 temples of various idols, may represent in some degree the number and division of inhabitants. Yet a French missionary declares that the town of Saint-Denis, near Paris, was more considerable than the Tatar capital, and that the whole palace of Mangu was scarcely equal to a tenth part of that Benedictine abbey. The conquests of Russia and Syria might amuse the vanity of the great Khans, but they were seated on the borders of China. The acquisition of that empire was the nearest and most interesting object, and they might learn from their pastoral economy that it is for the advantage of the shepherd to protect and propagate his flock. I have already celebrated the wisdom and virtue of a mandarin who prevented the desolation of 5 populous and cultivated provinces. In a spotless administration of 30 years, this friend of his country and of mankind continually labored to mitigate or suspend the havoc of war, to save the monuments and to rekindle the flame of science, to restrain the military commander by the restoration of civil magistrates, and to instill the love of peace and justice into the minds of Moguls. He struggled with the barbarism of the first conquerors, but his salutary lessons produced a rich harvest in the second generation. The northern, and by degrees the southern empire, acquiesced in the government of Kublai, the lieutenant and afterwards the successor of Mangu, and the nation was loyal to a prince who had been educated in the manners of China. He restored the forms of her venerable constitution, and the victors submitted to the laws, the fashions, and even the prejudices of the vanquished people. This peaceful triumph, which has been more than once repeated, may be ascribed in a great measure to the numbers and servitude of the Chinese. The Mughal army was dissolved in a vast and populous country, and their emperors adopted with pleasure a political system which gives to the prince the solid substance of despotism, and leaves to the subject the empty names of philosophy, freedom, and filial obedience. Under the reign of Kublai, letters and commerce, peace and justice were restored. The great canal of 500 miles was opened from Nanking to the capital. He fixed his residence at Peking, and displayed in his court the magnificence of the greatest monarch in Asia. Yet this learned prince declined from the pure and simple religion of his great ancestor. He sacrificed to the idol Fo, and his blind attachment to the lamas of Tibet and the bonzes of China provoked the censure of the disciples of Confucius. His successors polluted the palace with a crowd of eunuchs, physicians, and astrologers, while 13 millions of their subjects were consumed in the provinces by famine. 140 years after the death of Genghis, his degenerate race, the dynasty of the Yuan, was expelled by a revolt of the native Chinese, and the Mughal emperors were lost in the oblivion of the desert. Before this revolution, they had forfeited their supremacy over the dependent branches of their house, the Khans of Kiptsak and Russia, the Khans of Zagatai or Transoxiana, and the Khans of Iran or Persia. By their distance and power, these royal lieutenants had soon been released from the duties of obedience, and after the death of Kublai, they scorned to accept a scepter or a title from his unworthy successors. According to their respective situations, they maintained the simplicity of the pastoral life, nor assumed the luxury of the cities of Asia. But the princes and their hordes were alike disposed for the reception of a foreign worship. After some hesitation between the gospel and the Koran, they conformed to the religion of Muhammad. And while they adopted for their brethren the Arabs and Persians, they renounced all intercourse with the ancient Moguls, the idolaters of China. In this shipwreck of nations, some surprise may be excited by the escape of the Roman Empire, whose relics at the time of the Mughal invasion were dismembered by the Greeks and Latins. Less potent than Alexander, they were pressed, like the Macedonian, both in Europe and Asia, by the shepherds of Scythia. And had the Tartars undertaken the siege, Constantinople must have yielded to the fate of Peking, Samarkand, and Baghdad. The glorious and voluntary retreat of Batu from the Danube was insulted by the vain triumph of the Franks and Greeks. And in a second expedition, death surprised him in full march to attack the capital of the Caesars. His brother Borga carried the Tatar arms into Bulgaria and Thrace, but he was diverted from the Byzantine war by a visit to Novgorod in the 57th degree of latitude, where he numbered the inhabitants and regulated the tributes of Russia. The Mughal Khan formed an alliance with the Mamelukes against his brethren of Persia. 300,000 horse penetrated through the gates of Derbent, and the Greeks might rejoice in the first example of domestic war. After the recovery of Constantinople, Michael Palaeologus, at a distance from his court and army, was surprised and surrounded in a Thracian castle by 20,000 Tatars. But the object of their march was a private interest. They came to the deliverance of Azzedin, the Turkish sultan, and were content with his person and the treasure of the emperor. Their general, Noga, whose name is perpetuated in the hordes of Astrakhan, raised a formidable rebellion against Mengo Timur, the third of the Khans of Kiptsak, obtained in marriage Maria, the natural daughter of Palaeologus, and guarded the dominions of his friend and father. The subsequent invasions of a Scythian caste were those of outlaws and fugitives, and some thousands of Alani and Comans who had been driven from their native seats were reclaimed from a vagrant life and enlisted in the service of the empire. Such was the influence in Europe of the invasion of the Mughals. The first terror of their arms secured rather than disturbed the peace of the Roman Asia. The Sultan of Iconium solicited a personal interview with John Vataces, and his artful policy encouraged the Turks to defend their barrier against the common enemy. That barrier, indeed, was soon overthrown, and the servitude and ruin of the Seljukians exposed the nakedness of the Greeks. The formidable Hologu threatened to march to Constantinople at the head of 400,000 men, and the groundless panic of the citizens of Nice will present an image of the terror which he had inspired. The accident of a procession and the sound of a doleful litany, "From the fury of the Tartars, good Lord, deliver us," had scattered the hasty report of an assault and massacre. In the blind credulity of fear, the streets of Nice were crowded with thousands of both sexes, who knew not from what or to whom they fled. And some hours elapsed before the firmness of the military officers could relieve the city from this imaginary foe. But the ambition of Hologu and his successors was fortunately diverted by the conquest of Baghdad and a long vicissitude of Syrian wars. Their hostility to the Muslims inclined them to unite with the Greeks and Franks, and their generosity or contempt had offered the kingdom of Anatolia as the reward of an Armenian vassal. The fragments of the Seljukian monarchy were disputed by the emirs who had occupied the cities or the mountains, but they all confessed the supremacy of the Khans of Persia, and he often interposed his authority and sometimes his arms to check their depredations and to preserve the peace and balance of his Turkish frontier. The death of Kazan, one of the greatest and most accomplished princes of the House of Genghis, removed this salutary control, and the decline of the Mughals gave a free scope to the rise and progress of the Ottoman Empire. After the retreat of Genghis, the Sultan Gelaleddin of Karizmi had returned from India to the possession and defense of his Persian kingdoms.